Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Koh, your host, and thank you, as always, for tuning in. Today, we have Akshay Nanavati. He is a Marine Corps veteran. He is also an adventurer and an entrepreneur. This guy has a story. I mean, he had overcome drug addiction. He went overseas and was in the Iraqi war, suffered from PTSD, and had a serious battle with alcohol and drug abuse, which left him at the brink of a suicide. He shares this, his story, and how he reversed these things going on in his life into his latest work. Right now, he has a book coming out called Fearvana, the revolutionary science on how to turn fear into health, wealth, and happiness. He has been researching and studying how to overcome things for his own life. And in that effort, he turns that around into a book. I got a chance to read an early copy of the book, and it really was just well-written, filled with great bits of advice, a great story. I really think it's worth checking out. You can check it out at fearvana.com, and hopefully today's show, you'll hear a bunch of things. I learned a lot. I very much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed today's show. Today, we have Akshay Nanavati joining us. Did I get that close?
Nanavati, but almost perfect, almost there.
We talked about it before the show. I was like, I will not butcher it, but correct me if I do. Thank you so much for tuning in today and Jen coming on to share your journey and story with our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And I'm really excited to chat with you. Your story is just tremendous. So I know because I've been reading and I've been reading your latest, well, your book that's coming out in the fall, but people can pre-order it soon. But before we get into the book and everything going on with your current life, your backstory just, I'm sure you hear this, but really blew me away. You were in the Marines. You traveled the world. You ended up with PTSD. You had issues with drugs at one point. You've turned it all around, living this life of adventure and conquering fear is a main topic. Could you take us back and the listeners back to, you know, how life as a Marine, like how did that all get started? You know, just give us a little backstory here.
Yeah, sure. So when I was young, I moved around a lot. I was born in India and then moved to Singapore and Austin, Texas at 13. And so I guess through the moving, I was still a little unsure of myself. And, you know, I guess some kids are at that age and not everybody, of course, but I was a little lost and sort of wandering. And so I ended up about squandering about a year and a half of my life with drugs and lost two friends to that lifestyle. So we were pretty heavily immersed in it. And actually the movie Black Hawk Down, have you ever seen that movie?
Okay, I haven't, and I know. It's like a guy cult favorite.
Yeah, no, it's one of my favorite war movies, and it personally has a lot of impact on me because it literally, I mean, that movie set off a series of events that transformed my life. Watching the movie, you know, I still remember to this day going out and watching the movie, and it just triggered something in me. Watching the courage, because it's based on a true story, and watching the heroism of men in combat kind of made me ask myself, you know, would I have the ability to do that? And would I be able to sacrifice everything for a fellow human being?
Yeah.
And I didn't have an answer to that question. So I was disgusted with the life. It sort of triggered something in me that really got me upset with the life I was leading. And after that, I read book after book about military combat and decided ultimately to enlist in the Marines and find a new, more meaningful way to serve something greater than myself, but also to challenge myself. And from enlisting the Marines, that kind of presented its own challenge because I have a blood disorder called thalassemia, and two doctors told me that boot camp would kill me. So that took me about a year and a half to get a medical waiver because the condition itself was disqualifying, and I had to kind of fight my way into the Marines. But at that point, you know, I was so convinced that this was my path, this is what I needed to do, and I wouldn't listen to what anybody said was going to stop me.
I mean,
and
what was your family saying at this point? Were they just like,
oh, they were not too pleased. I mean, this was a post 9/11 world, so it was almost certain I would end up going to war. I was also not an American, right? I was an Indian citizen at the time of enlisting, so they were like, why are you fighting for this country, going to war? That was, you know, the politics of it weren't exactly Yeah. I mean, I myself didn't agree with a lot of the politics about it, but separate from the politics, it was, you know, we had a lot of battles about that, but they were also struggling because I had just come out of drugs, you know? So it was kind of one from you know, from one thing to another. I mean, I put my mom through hell without a doubt. I don't empathize with her one bit.
And was the process of just going into the Marine Corps, like, were you like, okay, I'm thinking about this? Was it like back and forth? Or was it one of these things where you just had a light bulb moment, walked yourself down there and like enlisted?
Oh, I mean, once I made the decision, I was like, no, nothing was going to come in my way. I initially wanted to go Army and go Army Rangers and go Special Forces because of the movie Black Hawk Down, where they're Army Rangers and Delta. But I wasn't a U.S. citizen, so I couldn't go Special Forces, which required a clearance in order to be Special Forces. So I decided to go Marines because, forgive any non-Marine and Army other listeners, but, you know, Marines were the best branches. So I had to. so I wanted to be in the best, right? So
well, all of us thank you for your commitment. And helping the country, and, you know, stepping up in that way. It's a good question, right? What would you do? I think a lot of us ask that question privately, and then we try to move on really quickly because we don't really want to face it. And you found yourself overcoming drug addiction, enlisting in the military, and then having a diagnosis of PTSD.
Yeah. So actually, from the Marines, I started exploring outdoor sports. So because I was in the reserves, I had some time about 3 years after enlisting, did I go to Iraq. But between that time, I started exploring outdoor sports as a new way to kind of explore my limitations and ultimately, push them. Then in 2007, I went to Iraq. So when I came back, was diagnosed a few years later, actually, I was diagnosed with PTSD, struggled with alcohol, and, you know, drinking had always been part of my life for a college student kind of thing, partying. But obviously looking back, I always kind of pushed drinking a little far probably than I should have. But, you know, as a college student, you're kind of partying, so whatever. And I always did well enough in school, so I never thought of it as a serious issue until it got to a breaking point where I literally thought of taking my own life. I just thought that this pattern of drinking and sobering up would never change. Mm. And so that finally, I still remember, and even sort of, it was like at about 5 a.m. after about a six day binge drinking, and the light kind of hit piercing through my shutters. And I still remember waking up and thinking that thought. And just the fact that I would even think that thought shocked me into some, I mean, that's why I even remember it, because of how shocking that thought was. And it just, you know, realized that something really needed to change. And I didn't like the kind of treatment I was getting, not to sort of blame the VA or anything. I actually had a good experience with them, but I just felt like the therapeutic methods, and it's not just, again, they had the best of intentions, so by no means separate from some of the controversies that they may have had. I just, the methods weren't serving me. So I actually started researching neuroscience and psychology to kind of heal my own brain. Mm. And that's what led to ultimately my book and some of everything that brought me to where I am now.
Oh, that makes a ton of sense. And so you just really had that, like, you sound like somebody who has these epiphany moments. Like, I'm going to enlist and I'm now going to like sober up and fix my life. It's amazing. So many people have trouble. They think about it, but it takes them a long time to take that action.
I think there's a gift and a curse to it, because often it has to really be metaphorically punched in the face to get that epiphany, though. From, like, you know, from wanting to potentially, and obviously now, like, you can talk about it in a lighter way than I could a few years ago, but to wanting to potentially take my own life, and even to losing friends and drugs. I mean, I was the first guy in our group of friends to really start pushing that line of the harder drugs. So you know, yeah. Maybe it's a gift, but sometimes it hit. I'm a slower learner than most, and so. But when it hits me, then I do tend to stick with the path. So I guess I've learned to fall many times, but also to somewhat keep coming back up. That's, I think, where maybe the biggest lesson that I've learned.
yeah, that the impulse, like, you're ready to go for it, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
Well, so you find yourself in a position where you're reading all these books, you're learning about how to help yourself, and you end up on Fearvana, the revolutionary science on how to turn fear into health, wealth, and happiness. How did that come about? What was the process? How come? I mean, I read the book. A lot of it is focused on specifically fear. How did you get there specifically?
So I had when I, you know, when I got out of that and I started reading books to heal myself and all of that, I came to realize that the finest moments in my own life, and that's why I touched on the outdoor sports from, you know, from rock climbing, skydiving, cave diving, skiing across a polar ice cap for a month, joining the Marines, serving in war, everything, and starting a business even, you know, writing a book even, it's the things that scare us that ultimately lead to our greatest growth. But fear is a very demonized emotion. I mean, when you say the word, people don't think of it as a positive. You know, you'll hear things like be fearless, don't be scared of this. You'll hear people tell you. And I realized why is that? That doesn't seem to make sense to me. And when I did the research, it showed up too that, you know, fear is the most primal emotion in the brain's always asking, is this thing going to kill me or not? That's our evolutionary speaking, our primary role is to survive. So fear is kind of this very primal emotion that we all experience at some point, but yet it's been so demonized. So Fearvana was this creation. My wife actually coined the word. And when she did, it was sort of a light bulb moment for us that this was gold, because it's if you look at it like nirvana and fear, right? The nirvana is that bliss, it's that enlightenment, and fear is this so-called negative, you know, the worst of the worst, and these kind of paradoxical and contrasting emotions that I believe are very complementary. And I think we find our bliss through our fears. And the book was about helping people reframe that. And I think the biggest mistake I've seen in my own life also in the past and also with people I work with is, you know, when fear shows up and then we say, oh, why am I scared? What's wrong with me? Like a quick anecdote, I was speaking to somebody who said, you know, I just need to wait for this fear to go away so I can quit my job. And I told him, that's your problem. You're waiting for the fear to go away. The fear is not going to go away. It's scary to quit your job to start your own business. The gift is embracing that fear. So the idea was to help people reframe their fear and ultimately harness it and use it to drive their lives forward. And that was kind of the inspiration of the concept itself as well as the book.
Yeah. And so you talk about that. You say it's like a bodyguard, right? And you want to focus on using it to your advantage. What do you mean by that?
I'll give you a quick kind of story of how, even while writing this, and then I'll kind of go a little bit more into the science of it. So when I was writing the book, I was out rock climbing, and I hadn't been rock climbing in a few years, so I was a little nervous again. And on the first climb, it was a relatively easy climb, and I was all scared, and I kept telling myself, you know, what's wrong with you? You've been climbing forever. You're a climber. What are you scared about? Like, stop being stupid. And I went climbing, and the first climb was a disaster. And I was just complete, you know, off balance, not in flow, anything. Second climb, it suddenly hit me that, wait a second, I'm writing a book about this. I should know better. And and I literally told myself, okay, it's normal to be scared. Whatever fear shows up, there's no bad or good fears. Your brain, if your brain has fear, it's doing what it knows best. You know, we don't control what first shows up in our brain. The subconscious brain chooses our emotion based on past patterns, on implicit memories, on everything that's brought us to who we are today. So I hadn't been climbing in a while. So my brain now looked at climbing, you know, climbing big heights. It's a scary thing. You fall, you could pretend, even though I was on rope, you're climbing high is tend to be scary. So I said, okay, why am I judging this fear instead of judging it? Let me just breathe it in. And I literally sat there, said, embrace the fear, breathed it in, and the second climb was just a ballet up that rock wall, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was graceful. It was a much harder climb, and I still made it so smooth and got to the top. And so that's what I mean by not judging our fears. And literally, when you choose to say, I can make this work, fear work for me, so many studies have shown that. I mean, like a quick study again, when they did with public speakers, public speaking is considered one of the biggest fears of all time. So it's a good example to use. They had half the group say things like, I'm coming, calm down before a speech. Uh-huh. And they had the other half group say, I'm excited, and sort of use their fear and breathe it in to transfer it into excitement. And the group that leveraged their fear instead of trying to eliminate it objectively performed significantly better to outside parties who were viewing and judging their speeches. So the point is that when we embrace our fears, we actually release chemicals in our brains like anandamide, which is the chemical for bliss, dopamine, it's the joy hormone, serotonin, endorphins. We're able to create these in our brain that allow us to then leverage fear to become stronger than we would be if we did not have the fear working for us. And that's why you see people in terrifying situations. And often you see the greatest of humanity come out through adversity. It's when I have friends in war who ran into a burning Humvee to save a fellow Marine. I've talked to athletes, you know, every athlete I've talked to, Ronda Rousey, the MMA fighter, said she's scared before every fight. Chris Bosh, when he was with Miami Heat and they won, said it's good to be scared before a fight. Bruce Springsteen used to throw up before his concerts because he said that. And Bruce Springsteen, I mean, he's the boss, right? But he used to throw up.
Yeah, Adele apparently suffers tremendously. She throws up before every concert she has.
It makes sense because fear can be that gift. And I think these kind of these performers know that it's not about eliminating that. It's about harnessing it. And when you do, you can make it work for you and you actually perform better. So that's really what I think Fearvana is about embracing that state to reach that higher level of ourselves.
And you talk about how, like, if we believe our human brain, the part that we say is ourself is in charge, and we don't recognize that the animal brain actually runs the show, that's when we get into trouble. Can you elaborate on what you mean? Because I think that's such an incredibly good point.
Sure, sure. So the idea behind that is kind of on this idea of free will. Now, we often think, you know, we like to think we're conscious, autonomous beings who choose our path. But now, for example, if I pick up this glass next of water next to me, brain science has shown that my brain registered that action like milliseconds up and up to sometimes a seconds in various studies before I actually committed it. So we are, and some scientists from, you know, Jared Zaltman, a psychologist from Harvard, said that 95% of cognition happens in the subconscious brain. So we are pretty much a product of our past patterns, of our habitual patterns, of our genes, of everything that has brought us to who we are today. And the value in recognizing that is when we can accept that the limitations of our free will, we are then able to step outside of it. So then I can say, okay, if I am purely a product of just, you know, habitual patterns, how can I then step out of these habitual patterns to consciously direct my being? And that's the value of ultimately accepting the limitations of free will. So then we can do something with it. And the sort of analogy I use in the book is, you know, if I had a happy, great, big house with that gave me everything I would need, I wouldn't be looking for another house, would I? So the same way, if we think of ourselves as autonomous beings with free will, we wouldn't be seeking that out. We wouldn't take action to actually find that autonomy and free will. So it's very important to accept that we are very much at the effect of our subconscious brain. And by doing so, then we can choose outside of those patterns and ultimately direct ourselves, you know, to who we want to be and achieving those longer term goals, whatever they may be.
And then you talk about this other point that according to Buddhist philosophy, but also science shows it, it's the pain, the thing that we've experienced in the past, and then the meta discussion about it that starts this down spiral of an experience. And you give the example of stubbing your toe. This is, I was in philosophy grad school. This was such a popular example. So you stub your toe on a table or something, right? Everybody knows that horrible experience.
Yeah.
In fact, in your brain, there's something called a C fiber firing. And it's like your brain is actually firing a whole bunch of responses to the pain. Mm. But there's this, and so instead of us saying like, ooh, C fiber firing, right? Like, wait, like just calling it what it is, which is a pain response, we start a secondary conversation, right? Okay. What's wrong with me? How come I did that? God, you know, I'm so stupid. I'm so, like, I should have known better. It's embarrassing, right? My friend actually, her son broke his leg and she kicked her son's cast and broke her toe.
Oh my God. Oh no.
Which is like hilarious, right? But like, then, you know, it's like embarrassing, right? But it's that meta discussion where you start layering them, right? And once you open Pandora's box into that next level and next level, it's when we're lost in it, right? We become lost in this negative loop. How do you think about how to stop that from happening? It's just recognizing the first pattern and stopping there.
Yeah, it's, you know, in Buddhist philosophy, they call it, the Buddha says we're all stabbed by the two darts. So it's very much, like you said, with the stubbing toe, the first dart is the pain in the toe. The second dart is our response to it. And the same thing applies to emotions. So for example, in the book, you know, I talk about the story when I went climbing with my wife. She went climbing and she was very afraid on this. We went kind of, it was more of a scramble. So she was very afraid. And then we got back down from the climb and the first dart was her fear because she couldn't control it. Her brain was responding with fear because it deemed these heights as potentially life-threatening and fear is a natural survival response. When we came back down, she then started judging herself, said, you know, you weren't afraid. What's wrong with me? Why am I afraid? And then sort of leading to this downward spiral of, oh, if I'm afraid, I won't be able to do, you know, to do this next thing I want to do. Maybe it reduces self-worth and it reduces self-esteem. And it leads to this whole downward spiral of what I call second dart syndrome. And it's really about interrupting that. It wasn't that I was any braver than her. The only reason my brain didn't show fear in that particular climb was because I had plenty more references. I had been climbing on much tougher routes very recently. So that appeared appeared to my brain as not a risk, you know? So it's literally stepping outside and saying, okay, this emotion happened. So for her, for example, she could say, she could use that and say, okay, I'm weak for feeling fear. Or she could then say, I have no control over that fear. I could now choose to say I climbed higher despite it, you know? And ultimately letting go of the, I mean, we all judge ourselves. We define ourselves by our emotions and our thought patterns, right? So it's about saying, I am not this emotion. I am not this thought. I'm something beyond that. And what I am is whoever I create myself to be, whoever I want to be. And so interrupting that downward spiral of second art syndrome, as I like to call it, is just saying that, okay, this is not me. This is just my brain stuck in a pattern beyond my control. Now that I'm aware of that, how can I reframe this experience to transfer it into something more meaningful? Could be either a physical action or a mental action, but either one of the two will start rewiring your brain patterns, and which will in time also change subconscious reactions that show up even initially to whatever external stimuli that may present itself.
Right. Once you get good at stopping that dialogue from continuing on and on and on, that subconscious dialogue doesn't just go on autopilot as easily.
Exactly. Yeah, you then start to interrupt that flow. And it's been, you know, by no means am I perfect. Sometimes when life gets stressful, I get caught up in it. But I'm definitely just doing the research for my book and practicing it, much more aware of it and noticing it, so I can say, hey, wait a second, you know, this emotion is just normal. Like I said, I mean, the other day when I was climbing while writing the book, I was like, got caught up in my own fear. And I was then second climb, I realized and stepped out of it. So it's really just constantly being that awareness to then translating it, that awareness then into action.
I think that's such an incredibly important point, because I've been at this for a long time and I have clients and they're like, you must just always be happy and joyous. And I'm like, no, I think, and the best way I've been able to describe it is similar to what you said. It's that the moment from when those thoughts kick in to when I interrupt them and let them go is just really short now. So it's, you know, once in a while I slip up and I find myself deep in some, you know, horrible thought system, but mostly I see it so quickly because I've cultivated that awareness, and then I've been able to interrupt it enough times that I recognize, oh, I am in control of this, which goes to this point that you make that we want to start a process of mastery over oneself, right? You get to accept the voice, the inner critic. It's not you, right? So all this stuff happening in my head, it's like, it's not me. And you get to stop making yourself guilty and right and wrong and beating yourself up and everything. That just that process, right, is it just gets easier.
Yeah, and I love the way you put it. I truly think that's the distinction between, you know, if you look at successful, like again, we were mentioning all these people like Bruce Springsteen and Adele. It's not that they don't have those same emotions like the rest of us do. It's just that that space between it is they're able to create to choose that response in the space between that emotion and the ultimate response to it. So and so, I love the way you put it. You're able to, you know, not let that to use that space to and leverage it faster than otherwise being caught up in the spiral.
Yeah. Do you have a suggestion for somebody listening who's like, ooh, I want to shorten that process? How does somebody start to do that?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a little 5-step tool that I'll briefly run through. It goes into kind of more detail as well. And it's spelled out LMNOP. So it's kind of easy to remember. L is the first step is label the emotion. So whatever you're feeling, label it. And they've shown by labeling the emotion, it actually reduces activity in the subconscious and increases activity in the parts of the brain related to focus and awareness. And so the second part of the L is language. So Amy Cuddy, who does a great TED talk about power poses, talk about how you can shift your body language and ultimately change the physiology in your body as well. So L is label and language. The next step is M. Ask yourself, what is the meaning that's created X emotion? Where our brain is always finding meanings to things. So you're digging deep now to find what that meaning is, the subconscious meaning that's kind of being automatically created. The N is where you literally tell yourself, and this is kind of what I believe the most powerful part and the revolutionary part of this, the process is where N is, it's not me, it's my brain. So now you're separating yourself from the emotional impact of it. So for example, if you're struggling with depression, and I worked with somebody who was struggling depression, and they'd say, I am depressed, I have depression, instead of saying, I have moments where my brain is depressed, but that is not me, and I am not my brain. So now all of a sudden, I'm not saying I have depression or I am a depressed person. I'm just saying this is my brain in a pattern I can't control. It's not me. And then the O is where you opt for a new meaning. So you, whether you believe it or not, you might not register, dig deep, but you start rewiring the brain by consciously choosing a new meaning to the depression or to the event causing it or both. And then finally, the P is what I call a purpose or preemptive strike. So purpose is taking some new action in line with your purpose, whoever you want to be, your goals, whatever you, you know, whatever ultimately you call it, your destiny, whatever, however you perceive that kind of idea, but taking some new action, which will start rewiring the brain. And preemptive strikes is setting up systems then to, that's why I call it the LMNOP cycle, is setting up systems to be aware of when patterns will show up that you know will lead you down the same spiral so you can prevent it ahead of time. So like a small example of that was when I had a client call, I had two client calls back to back one morning and I hadn't slept all night. So I knew I would be tired and want to take a nap. So what I did, but I also had a 5-mile run scheduled after my client calls. So what I did was I put on my running shoes, my GPS watch, my iPod around my armband, you know, stayed fully ready. So by the time my client call was done, I made it as psychologically easy as possible to go out the door. And then once I stepped out the door, all I had to do was finish the run. Because otherwise, all those little steps could have been easy enough for my brain to say, you know what, I'll just go for a nap. So that's kind of a preemptive strike to prepare for obstacles you know will show up. Mm-hmm. And that tool has been really powerful. It's helped people I know with depression, PTSD. It's helped me in many, many ways as well. So I think that should help, if you practice it and keep kind of going through those steps. It'll be really transformational.
Awesome. I love it. And I love the LMNOP. That's adorable. Okay, I want to dive in for a second here, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay, so this has come up a couple times as we've been talking, and it's one of my favorite topics. And you've mentioned it a handful of times, so I wanted to hear your thoughts. But this question of it's not me, it is me. It's not me, it is me. It's not me, right? One of the biggest challenges is this question. I have these thoughts in my head, it's me, right? Mm. And yep. I noticed when I was writing my book, the thoughts in my head not only feel like me, but they use my voice. They use the cadence, the vocabulary. They sound like me, right? So how do I figure out where I am? And there was a point in my life where literally if my truest self had stood up, screamed in my face, I wouldn't have known the difference between that and fear or judgments or whatever. Until I started getting into more of this literature, and this one idea of the blue sky versus the clouds was the one that really stuck with me, where our thoughts are like the clouds and I'm just the blue sky, right? So we look up at the sky and we say, oh, it's gray today. And it's like, no, it's not. It's blue. The sky is always blue. You're talking about clouds.
I like that. Okay.
How do you, for people listening and they're like, it's not me, the fear. It's not me, the judgment. It's not me. How do you feel the difference, right? For me, it's a very, I can now feel it in my body. I can tell when it's the spun out thoughts, they create a chaos, they create secondary conversations. It feels like a loop versus that sort of stillness in me that I call the blue sky. How do you differentiate that in your life?
You know, one of the things as you kind of mentioned, and I love that analogy you gave as well, but is definitely elements of practice, practicing that self-awareness and registering. And so simple action that you can even do regularly, just labeling emotions and separating yourself then from that emotions. And ultimately, I also believe that there is no us, like there is no inherent me or to find. I don't believe we find ourselves. I believe we create ourselves, and whoever we want to be is who we decide to be. So with that said, you know, when you say, when I come back to that LMNOP and the higher purpose, it's really saying, who do I want to be? What do I want to be to the world? Who I want to give, you know, how do I want to give? How do I want to serve? Whatever those questions may be, and being very present to that sense of self. So then you can step outside of whatever shows up. So quick example, again, stories sometimes, you know, stories are obviously helpful. So when I go for long runs, they are still miserable. I mean, I'll go for the other day to 30 miler up a big hill near my place in India where I'm at. And I mean, at the end of it, you know, I mean, not even at the end, towards the closer, like midway through it, I'm just thinking to myself, why am I doing this? This is awful. I hate this. This is miserable, you know? And, and then after that, obviously I come back and plan my next run. But by stepping outside of those moments of pain, is when I can say, why am I doing this? And then there's realizing that moment of struggle, that moment, I think when we hit our limitations, when we get to say, when we test ourselves and say, okay, do I want to quit? Do I want to rise above this? That moment allows us to discover in greatness in ourselves that we may not know we had before. And as long as we keep discovering what that moment is, so that moment could show up for somebody at a 1-mile run. For me, it might be now on a 30-mile run. And there's no rightness or wrongness. It's not that I'm better. It's just, but the more we experience that moment, the greater we create ourselves, the greater we become, and the greater we are able to channel ourselves above our suffering, to rise above our suffering. And I truly believe one of the most positive, the most important skills we can develop is really developing a positive relationship to any sort of suffering. Because as you know, as you were saying with your own experience, and as I'm sure anybody knows, we all suffer. Suffering will always happen in some way or the other. And when you learn to suffer with a smile, you can truly then transcend your suffering. And a great way to do that is simply just practice. And that's why I love exercise. I mean, exercise to me is my go-to model. I mean, again, barring sort of physical disabilities or anything, almost anybody can do it at any point. And it's a great way to test yourself, explore your limitations. And when you hit that moment saying, do I want to quit? And every time you don't quit and you respond to that voice with a will that you didn't know you had, you will suddenly create a new you. And that creating new you will push your boundaries, you know, further and further that you – and there's really no limitations of how far that can go. And that to me is just the beauty of constantly rising above your suffering. And when you do that, you'll hit more goals than you could ever imagine. I mean, it's just become such a gift for me to be able – that's how I quit drinking almost overnight, you know, stopped addiction through all of these processes. And now you learn to achieve whatever you set your mind to. And it's a beautiful thing that I think there's a lot of joy in that, obviously, in that journey.
Yeah, no, really beautifully put. I love it. And, you know, for anybody listening out there that's not catching all of it, don't worry. All of this is outlined in his book, which will be available to pre-order and to purchase coming in October. So I think everything you're saying is right on. And I think that's a really interesting perspective, creating oneself as you're going, because, right, the blue sky is just an image of there's a part of you that's outside of those thoughts, but what is it, right? It's almost like this blank canvas that you get to create. And so I noticed in your book, you talk about fear, you take us through, you know, a lot of the ideas that you've discussed about how to manage fear, to sort of think about it differently, to sort of in the face of fear, different ways to overcome the challenges that might be in front of you. I couldn't help but notice you moved over to surrendering, the gift of surrendering. Why? I love surrendering. It's something that I hated that word for so many years of my life. To me, it was like the white flag of giving up and just, you know, like surrender and failure to me were one and the same. But now I love it. So tell me about why you moved over to the gift of surrendering.
So I think surrendering is very much about surrendering to the limitations of ourselves, again, up to the limitations of our free will, surrendering to something. I mean, only recently have I, you know, at the end of the book, the last chapter is called Love, Faith, and Fear, where sometimes there's something more, you know, there's that combination. And if, you know, I tend to be very pragmatic, rational, I'm always looking for a reason, for science, but there's something in faith that I don't know what it is. You can call it a faith in God or the universe, whatever label you want to use. And I think that surrendering to say that there's something inside of us that we can tap into that's so much greater than ourselves. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the two-part surrendering. It's surrendering to the limitations of just, you know, our brain being what it's our brain is going to do. It's what it's going to do, and we are very much a product of our past and who we are. So kind of accepting that and surrendering to it, and then using that to then drive ourselves forward, and at the same time then taking surrendering to a different level of surrendering to some faith of what we can be, and saying that, you know, I can't control all of this, but I can control, you know, I can control my attitude, and I can then surrender a faith to that what will happen, and all I can do in the meantime is control my faith and control my attitude in response to it. So for example, when I was in Iraq, you know, for the first month and a half of my deployment, I hated my life. My journals were angry. I used to be miserable. And ultimately I learned that, I mean, I came to realize that I can't change my environment. For the next 5.5 months, I would still be in war. I would still be miserable. All I could do was surrender to that circumstance, because that was a circumstance outside my control, and then accept the attitude of how I wanted to reframe it and how I wanted to respond to it. Like Viktor Frankl, you know, psychiatrist and author of Man's Search for Meaning, one of the most powerful books I've ever read, he says that between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our power to choose our response, and in our response lies our growth and our freedom. So surrendering is sometimes accepting when that stimulus is something we can control and saying, okay, how can we just choose our response?
Yeah.
And there's a real power in that.
Totally. I mean, the Stoics, like so many people talk about it, and it's so obvious when you think about certain things, right? Like I'm not going to try to reach my arms around a tree and lift it up. But there are all these other things in life where you have falsely convinced yourself, I have the ability to force my will onto it, like you being deployed. And that I'm, you know, like, if you're there and in fact you have no other option, why keep pushing into it, right? And it's like, yeah, creates so much misery and suffering.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
To this day, you say, my greatest fear is stillness. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, you know, it's a fear that I've definitely started to now engage and getting work and working on getting better at. But, you know, I realized that for a long time, I mean, obviously alcohol was one way to run away from myself, but I realized that so was my adventures. I mean, yes, they can be perceived as positive, like exercise, going to the gym, running can be perceived as positive things, right? But in many ways, they were ways to also run away from myself. And stillness is a hard, hard thing to face. I don't think just for me, I think we can all struggle with it. Mm-hmm. And especially in today's world where we're bombarded with constant stimuli from 20 different devices and, you know, everything bombarding us. But how do we then turn it all off and just be? And you know, part of it is also the meditation, but actually I've learned a new training technique, which I've implemented that I've found to be extremely challenging, but invaluable at the same time. I learned it from a friend of mine who actually, he did a cycle race across America. I think it's considered the toughest bicycle race in the world. He biked across America for 11 days, sleeping about 11 hours the entire time. And, you know, I mean, he would hallucinate. It was just mind-blowing endurance event. And he was telling me one of the things he would do in his training where he would sit still in a room with no stimuli, so no music, no TV, not even a painting to, like, observe, just a wall, and be still for up to 24 hours and then go riding for 24 hours. So, I mean, I'm not even at the close to the point where I can sit still for 24 hours. I'd probably drive myself insane. But what I'm doing now is building myself up with 15 a minute a week. So sitting still for an hour right now and just staring into the floor, staring at the wall and watching where your mind takes you. And it is a fascinating and terrifying and beautiful ride. You know, it's I mean, I remember the first time I did it too. I was like, I think my timer might be broken. Should I check? You know what I mean? I feel like it's been forever.
Mm-hmm. No, it's really brutal. My first experience was in my yoga teacher training program. The guy who ran it, I keep busting him out publicly too. It's funny, but he was like, okay, we're going to learn to meditate. And I thought, okay, cool. We're going to talk about it. We go in a room, we go into a circle. He hits this little bowl to get it started and says, see you in 30 minutes. And I was like, what? I started sweating. It was like the worst idea ever. I'm like, what? And like, it was like a pin could drop in that room for 30 straight minutes, right? But I mean, that's it's a deep question. Like, we can't sit quietly with ourselves. What's going on, right? It's your thoughts are that out of control. If you're then conscious because you're sitting still that those thoughts are moving at that pace, just because you're unconscious to it doesn't mean it doesn't have an effect, right? It was just a really...
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Powerful idea. So I ask everybody who comes on the show, I wanted to ask you, what does an authentic life mean to you?
So I think an authentic life, you know, especially considering some of the conversations we've had and just the past, this the last topic is, it's hard because we were talking about who we are, right? And who we are. So authentic is ultimately being integrity, being in alignment with who we are, but who is that self? And that's a hard self to figure out when we're told by the world, this is who we should be. This is what success means, who we really ultimately should be. And I think we discovered that through pursuing what I call a worthy struggle, you know? And so I think that authentic life and being authentic is about discovering what your worthy struggle is and committing your entirety of your being to it, you know, and that worthy struggle can change. But once I think you truly find the right one, it will stick. So for example, you know, I have friends who are screenwriters. I have friends who who's about to be a grandmaster in chess. None of those pursuits are easy. Running ultramarathon, none of these things are easy. Starting a podcast, building a business like you have, none of these things are easy, but you've chosen this worthy struggle and you pursued it. And once, because struggle is pure, it sheds that sense of, it really discovers you in a different way, because then that's when you, like I said, like we were talking about, exploring your limitations. So I think there's a kind of beauty and purity to suffering that allows you to tap into a sense of self that then allows you to be authentic to that sense of self. So I truly believe it's about finding that worthy struggle and then committing your entirety of being of it. And once you discover that and once you commit yourself to it, that journey is what gives you that authentic, that being authentic. And there's no right or wrong worthy struggle. It can be anything or everything, as long as you feel like it's your worthy struggle in alignment with who you are, who you want to be. And I mean, as you know, as I've shared my story, it took me a little bit of a road to get here, but I feel like I've now kind of figured it out, and at least in terms of what my worthy struggle is. And there'll always be a sort of a next struggle, but it's now kind of an under one umbrella path of what that struggle is. And then committing myself to it and embracing the suffering and the struggle on the journey is, to me, what I believe it is to find authenticity and then ultimately live an authentic life.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like I should jump on Twitter, worthy struggle. Do you have a worthy struggle? That's such a great way of saying it. I love it. And so we've talked about your path to a life that has meaning and a lot of the ways that you face fears. What is your daily practice? Do you have certain things that you do on a regular basis to keep you in a, you know, on track with what you're trying to do, a life of purpose and meaning?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, obviously meditation, as I mentioned now, with stillness, that was a hard one, but I've managed to create that habit pretty consistently. So meditation, some simple ones. And one of the things that I find to be very valuable is whatever area you want to improve is in tracking it. So I've started tracking my time, being very conscious of where that's being invested and being then very proactive about how I can reframe it. So I'll give you a small example. By tracking my time, I figured out that I spent 14 minutes making a vegetable smoothie. Ultimately, I realized, okay, there's probably systems I can use to improve it. And then I improved it to 7 minutes. And I discovered that over, I can't remember when I actually did the math, but when I discovered that over the math of like X amount of years, it translates to 6 extra months of living. And so being very conscious about where my time is going, because time is our most valuable resource that doesn't come back. You know, this minute we've had a conversation, this half hour, whatever, it's gone. It's never going to come back. And being very aware that if I'm saying yes to one thing, I'm always saying no to something else. And at the same time, by saying no to something else, I'm saying yes to something. So being conscious about that, those are some habits. Exercising is invaluable to me and even brain science has shown it's one of the best ways to improve your brain. And one of the final things that actually is really helpful, and also just kind of staying present to my goals. So I'm always aware of what is my 90-day goals, my weekly goals. I track everything. I have a daily journal I track at the end of the day. But one of the recent discoveries I found to be really transformational, and I'd love to share, is with music. Actually, what I've started doing is creating activation triggers to control the states of being that I want to be in. So whatever state, because our states of being will shape our moment, which will then shape our actions, which will then shape our destiny, right? So if I want to be in a state of being that's relaxed, what I've started doing now is creating a series of checklists. Okay, let me put me in relax mode. And then it could be, but if I want to get in go mode, which means either writing or exercise, I have a very specific song, this kind of music compilation, 3.5 minutes that I put together. And I've managed to anchor that in my brain now that every time I listen to it, it's almost like that Pavlovian response, you know, mm-hmm. like a dog sees food and he salivates. Mm-hmm. It's like when my brain hears that, I'm in go mode. So learning to switch on and off at will has been transformational, because I mean, if you just think about what that means, if I can go on and off to whatever state of being I want to be in at will, I can ultimately then translate that to any action and then ultimately create my destiny in any way I want it to be, right?
Yeah.
So those are some of the few things about leveraging action into awareness. And sort of, so just one quick thing I share in my book is ultimately I think all process of growth is a series of two steps. It's find the problem, fix the problem, and find what's working and doing more of it. So I'm always very present of that. I'm saying, okay, here's what's working. Let me do more of it. And here's what's the problem is. And how do I fix this to move on? And I always think there should be a problem. If there's not a problem, you're probably not growing. There should be some problem you're looking to solve. So, okay, I'm now, my next goal is to run a 50 miler. I'm not there yet. So there's the gap there. How do I fix that gap? Mm-hmm. So I'm always looking at these life from these two perspectives and addressing it. Which actually led me to creating these triggers. So it was a matter of finding a problem. Here's a problem. I got to fix it. And then I found these, you know, creating these activation triggers. So sorry to interrupt, but yeah, just wanted to share that as I thought it'd be useful.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I love it. And I think the things that we've incorporated into our lives and sharing that with others is such a helpful thing because, you know, we have the real experience of it. Thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing all of this information. Your story is so inspiring. The way you choose to live your life is equally inspiring. If people are looking to find out more about you, where can they find you?
So the website will be fearvana.com. That's fear and then V-A-N-A, fearvana.com, where you can definitely check out my book, if you will. And also feel free to reach out to me. I love helping and answering any questions that come my way. So please feel free to reach out. Always here to serve.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on The Art of Authenticity.
Thank you for having me, Laura. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hey, before you go, I have a quick question for you. Have you ever considered coaching? If you have no idea what coaching is, no worries. It's basically like a personalized workout program, but instead of doing 100 squats and a million sit-ups, you're working out your mind, your well-being, and your emotions. Coaching is about setting goals and taking action to create a life that's meaningful to you. As we navigate through life and ask ourselves the tough questions, what do I want? What makes me happy? How do I build a life that works for me? Just like we talk about on the podcast, how do I have success, but have success that's authentic and meaningful? In part, the tactics play a huge role. Setting goals, having priorities that make sense, and making sure you're organized with your lists. After running a company for 15 years, I help my clients with that all the time. But coaching takes it even further. We remove all that stuff, all those mental obstacles that get in your way when you're trying to make those tough life choices. If that sounds interesting to you, come on over to lauraco.com, click on the contact form and send me a note, or at the bottom of the homepage, you'll see a button where you can click and set up a call with me. Just like that, it's free. We'll chat, we'll find out what's going on and see if it makes sense for me to help you out. No strings attached. I hope to hear from you. And again, thank you so much for tuning in. I really value each and every one of you.